The Tom Woods Show, episode 1085.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, if you thought Bernie Sanders and his ideas would just go away, boy, have you been proven wrong. Best way to fight back? Grab my free ebook, Bernie Sanders is Wrong, over at BernieIsWrong.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. You know, the other day, I happened to come across this interview that I totally forgot about. I interviewed Robert Higgs, who's been a guest on this show a couple of times, but this was back in 2011, before there even was a Tom Woods show. I was filling in for Peter Schiff, and some of you folks, I think, started listening to me because you heard me as a guest host for Peter. And I got Higgs on there. We talked about some really interesting things. We talked about the New Deal, which he's done a lot of work on. We talked about what was going on in the years following the bailouts and the wisdom or otherwise of those policies. And it's a terrific interview. Everything with Higgs in it is just a gem to be preserved. And I came across this and I thought, what a blast from the past. It's a great interview with a lot of good information, particularly about the question of unemployment during the 1930s. This is all good stuff. Bob Higgs is a very, very significant figure in the libertarian movement, a very significant scholar. He's the author of many books. His book, Crisis and Leviathan, Critical Episodes in the Growth of American Government, was published by Oxford in 1987 and is just a classic work. But he's published many books besides that one, taught at numerous colleges and universities. He's now retired and lives in Mexico. But we have got this interview that you, chances are, have never heard before, and we're going to listen to it today. So here we go, and enjoy. Right now, we are joined by Robert Higgs, and I've been teasing you guys that this is a guy who's basically written every book ever. It seems like it's his catalog increases by the day, it seems. Bob holds a PhD from Johns Hopkins University. He's taught at numerous colleges and universities. He is an economist, but also a great historian. And he's perhaps best known for his 1987 book, published by Oxford University Press, Crisis and Leviathan, that tries to look at the preconditions for government growth. What had to happen for this to take place that we see all around us? And what were the steps by which it occurred? It's a very, very important book. But more recently, he's written Depression, War, and Cold War, where he's done, this is very, very important stuff, because not only does he write for the general public, but he's writing for scholars, and he has single-handedly forced the textbook authors to concede that there is another story about the U.S. economy during the 1940s, during World War II, that the alleged wartime prosperity was just a phantom. It's a figment of the data, and the data is perverse and distorted and meaningless. This is very, very important stuff. He's also talked about the Great Depression, why it lasted so long. This is great, important, original work. He's also the author of Neither Liberty Nor Safety, Against Leviathan, Resurgence of the Warfare State, and still others. So it's my great pleasure to welcome to the program Bob Higgs. Bob, thanks for being with me this morning.
Glad to be here, Tom.
Well, Bob, so much to talk about. You and I are sort of like professional mythbusters, and you notice we haven't gone out of business. We're not having any early retirement because of lack of work. We're not going to be technologically unemployed anytime soon. So let's start off with some current events here. I mean, in your judgment, why has the economic recovery, such as it is, or why has the economy been so sluggish since what happened in 2008? Why didn't we have a swift turnaround? What's the problem?
Well, Tom, I think the problem this time is exactly the same as, in general terms, the problem during the Great Depression. As you know very well, the Great Depression was the first occasion in American history in which the federal government acted very vigorously and on a wide scale to do something about a business bust. And that's why it became the Great Depression. Because of what the government was doing allegedly or ostensibly to fix it, the actions the government took had the effect in general of impeding the operation of the price system, which normally would have been working to restructure the use of resources in the economy to repair the distortions that had been brought about by government monetary policy, especially during the 1920s. and to get things going again so that resources that had potentially valuable uses were put to those uses. But because of the actions the government took under Hoover and Roosevelt, the normal market restructuring was obstructed, slowed, even prevented. A great many goofball ideas were tried by the federal government, and the result of that was that instead of having a business bust that was cleared away in a year or two or three at most, we had a business depression that lasted well over a decade. So that story has been repeated in general terms. The details are different, of course, but this time the recession was getting underway in 2008, slowly until the financial debacle in September, and then very rapidly after that. The government and the Federal Reserve System began to act in a whole variety of unprecedented large-scale ways. And the general effect of these government actions, which were all aimed supposedly at preventing catastrophe, was to turn what otherwise would have been a recession and a financial disturbance that took a while to clear away into something that's lasting now already for 4 years, and looks as if it may last another 4 years or more.
Now, Bob, you've sort of piqued my interest on the Great Depression question. I want to dwell there for just a minute. I want to ask you something that I've kind of wondered about myself. Now, when you look at the employment figures in the 1930s, it's a pretty grim picture. The average unemployment rate is about 18% from 1933 to 1940. But there's been some controversy about how to measure unemployment, in that there are some economists who would say that we should count the people who are on work relief as being employed, because after all, they are doing actual work. On the other hand, there are people who say, but we should not count them as being employed, because if these are jobs that can be sustained only by infusions of government money, then they're not. There's no unambiguous way in which we can say that they're contributing to human welfare, so we can't count them as being employed. Now, I'm inclined in that direction, that we don't count those people, like in the Works Progress Administration or whatever, as being employed. But the problem with that position seems to me that it seems from that argument we could then say that we shouldn't count anybody in government as being employed. I mean, would that lead us to the position of saying that even Hillary Clinton today, the Secretary of State, she's unemployed because, you know, I don't pay for her services. That's not a service that I voluntarily acquire. How do you make sense of that issue?
I think there are various ways to do it, Tom. One way is simply to look at all the measures and to think about what they are telling us. We can look at the standard unemployment rate, which, of course, there were no unemployment rates estimated or published during the Depression itself, so there was a lot of guesswork at the time. But later, Stanley Liebergott, working for the Bureau of Labor Statistics, created what now serves as the standard statistical series on the rate of unemployment in the 1930s. And what Stanley did, and what seemed reasonable for a long time, was to count these people who were on emergency employment programs like the WPA as unemployed, and that's how you get this average 18% figure for the decade of the 30s. Of course, from 1933 onward, the government began to employ millions of people, and so if you count them as employed, you get a different measure, one often called the Darby measure, after an economist who reestimated the unemployment rate in this way back in the 1970s. But what Darby found was that if you look at the unemployment rate, counting these government emergency employees as employed, then you find, of course, a much lower unemployment rate. You get the same general pattern, however, and Darby had some ideas about how the labor markets were working in the 1930s and why people were still unemployed as long as they were. But the main contribution was just to give us another statistical series that we could compare with the standard Liebergott series. Now we can still do that. We can think about what we're seeing there, whether we're seeing a genuine recovery of private employment or whether we're just seeing a lot of make work. These government jobs are very difficult to assess. I don't think we can simply say that these jobs had zero value. They had some value. They created some outputs of some value. We don't know how much because when products and services are not created in free markets, we really don't know how much value people attach to them, if any. But at all events, that's one way to proceed. Just look at all the data we have. Now, I've taken a different approach in a way. Instead of looking at anybody's rate of unemployment for the 1930s, I've recently just gone back and said, well, let's look at employment. That way we don't have to worry about who's classified as out of work or not. Let's just go back and look at how many hours specifically in the private economy were being worked from year to year during the 1930s. And when we do that, we get a somewhat different picture than we get from looking at unemployment rates for the 1930s. And one of the interesting things to me is that looking at private employment in particular, we find that the depression is not V-shaped. One of the claims of many of the Keynesians is that the New Deal really did work to turn the economy around, because you see it was headed straight down through 1933, and as soon as the New Deal took over, it started going straight up again. And if you look at private employment hours worked during the 30s, what you find is it's not V-shaped at all, it's U-shaped. There's very little difference between 1932, 33, and 34. So that even when the New Deal was well underway, it was not having much effect in causing a recovery of private hours worked. You get some muddying of the water back then because there was a lot of work spreading. And so sometimes when you had an additional person employed, it didn't mean that you had many more hours being worked because many people were working reduced hours.
My guest is Bob Higgs of the Independent Institute. Check them out at independent.org. He's also the editor of their journal, Independent Review. We're going to take a break now, and on the other side of that break, we're going to ask Bob more about what's going on today, and in particular about what the government's been doing, and has it worked, has it not worked, and was TARP a good idea after all? I mean, the world didn't come to an end, so maybe that proves that it was the best thing to do. We're going to take on these issues and more. On the other side of this break, you're listening to The Peter Schiff Show, the gold standard in talk radio. All right, everybody, welcome back to The Peter Schiff Show. I'm Tom Woods, in for Peter, joined by Robert Higgs of the Independent Institute, independent.org, author of Crisis and Leviathan and other books that you should be reading. Bob, we're talking about the just miserable economy, and I just want to ask you, I know you've written a little bit about this, but, I mean, what do you make of the argument that no thanks to naysayers like you and me, the economy more or less managed to hang on by a thread thanks to wise interventions by our economic managers at the Federal Reserve and in the Treasury? And if people had listened to us, we would have spiraled into a depression and we just haven't learned the lessons of the past. I think if I hear that propaganda line one more time, I think I'm going to go out and commit an atrocity. So I don't know how you feel about this, but how do you respond to that?
Well, the first response is that's a kind of story that's really irrefutable. They say, you know, if these things had not been done, then catastrophe would have resulted. Well, you say that, so what? I say you're wrong. And why do I say you're wrong? Because, one, it's never happened that way in the past. We've never had, say, an event where a financial stringency started causing various interest rates and financial markets to rise, and merely as a result of that, the whole U.S. or world economy fell into a shambles. That just isn't the way history has ever unfolded before. Not even during the early 1930s did things blow up overnight like that. As I was saying a minute ago, when things started to go wrong in 1929, the government immediately began to act in ways that exacerbated that downturn and made it a deep depression. So if we know something about the course of history in the past, and if we know how markets work, to understand how markets work is to understand how markets provide feedback when mistakes are made. And I think many people simply have never absorbed this aspect of the market system. Price changes, profit changes, loss changes, all these things are signals telling people, look, here's the way to go to get out of trouble or to avoid trouble or to make a million. So if the price system is working, it's constantly telling people what has been done correctly and what has been done mistakenly. But when the government starts to act in ways that obstruct the price system, it distorts these signals and starts telling people to do the wrong things to correct the situation. Mistakes have been made. How are we going to fix them? Well, how are we going to know if the government will not allow the price system to transmit the signals that tell us how to do the right thing in the current circumstances? And so I find this story about you know, Man of the Year and all the rest of it just verging on a fairy tale. It's pure ideology as far as I can see.
Now, Bob, unfortunately, we've got only a few minutes left. Oddly enough, I don't see how the time could have gone so fast. But I want to ask you about as a follow-up, we're talking about the economy right this minute. I want to ask you about something that a number of Keynesians have tried to say, that when we raise the kind of argument that you make about how the economy did after World War II with the demobilization and cutting of spending, and we had the best year ever for the private economy in 1946, that there's nothing to fear about government cutbacks. Some of them have been willing to say, yeah, that's all well and good, but the difference is that now we're in a balance sheet recession, that households are indebted, and they're going to be spending their money, if they've got any, on debt repayment, and that's not good for the economy. So we need the government to spend so that money will get in their pockets, and that'll revive private spending. In just a few minutes, what do you say to that?
Well, I think there are two things to say. One is that it misunderstands what happened after World War II. For one thing, there were lots of balance sheets distortions at that time, largely because people had been unable to purchase a lot of consumer goods during the war, and so the saving rate had been extraordinary. It'd been up around 20 to 25% during the war, and so that had put people in a position they really didn't want to be in. And when the war ended and those constraints were lifted, then there was a lot of distortion built into the structure of financial markets and people's portfolios and all the rest of it. So it wasn't that situation was completely different from now. The other response I would make is that yes, there's been a lot of buildup of debt, private and governmental, in recent years, but the question is one of magnitudes. Does it mean that people are simply going to use all their additional income to repay debts? No, it doesn't mean that. It probably means that some income is going to be steered toward reducing people's leverage where they've got themselves in trouble. But once again, we need to remember that not everybody in the United States got himself in trouble during the boom. Not everybody has an underwater mortgage. Not everybody is maxed out on his credit cards. We need to think in terms of the proportions that are relevant to our situation right now. And very often people reason as if the representative party in the economy is some unemployed Californian with his mortgage deeply underwater, and no means of getting a job in the next few years. Well, that's simply not the typical person in the economy right now. And if we use that as our benchmark for thinking about our situation, we'll simply make mistakes.
Robert Higgs, ladies and gentlemen of the Independent Institute. Bob, thanks for taking some time with us today. I much appreciate your expertise and your good-naturedness as you have to basically answer the same fallacies day after day, year after year. You're an example to us all. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Well, thanks for having me on, Tom.
All right. Now, before you go, I want to tell you something about the next episode of Contra Krugman, which is the podcast I do with Bob Murphy, where every week we critique a column by Paul Krugman. And you can find that podcast at ContraKrugman.com. Well, this week, whether or not you like Bitcoin or interested in Bitcoin, you're going to love this episode. Krugman has a column about how shady and bubbly Bitcoin is and how stupid it is, and the sooner it's gone, the better. But we just have some great banter. And for those of you who have been rooting for me, because I'm kind of the underdog on that show. Bob's very quick-witted, and I'm kind of the underdog. As you're driving, listening to episode 124, which will be out probably by February 2nd, that's Friday, or at the latest Saturday, February 3rd, you're going to be pumping your fist in the air in the car as you're driving, because Woods finally gets a few good ones in there, okay? It took me 124 episodes, man, but this is my time. It's here. So check out, if you haven't been listening to Contra Krugman, check it out. If you are, then you're in for a real treat with episode number 124. Check it out at ContraKrugman.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. All right, see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.